to paragraph 4, actually. Yesterday I left you with a question. What is the difference between Ruach HaKodesh, Holy Spirit, and prophecy? Now let's review what I said about a little bit of what I said about Ruach HaKodesh, and then we'll go on to what he says about prophecy. Maybe you can hear what I read, what I translate, where the difference lies. In Ruach HaKodesh, the person is given knowledge of various matters, given understanding of various things, ideas, facts, above that is prophecy. And the concept of prophecy, the essence of prophecy is that a person attaches himself to the Creator, binds himself to him with actual binding, connection, so that he will feel that connection, and he'll know who he's binding himself to, which is Kvodo, God's glory, whatever that means, as we will explain inside, he says. And it will be clear to him without any doubt whatsoever, just as it's clear to you when you look at a table, it's looking at a table, and there's no room for doubt whatsoever. Do you hear a difference in direction between Ruach HaKodesh and prophecy?
One seems like that it's more like it's given, and the other one is more that you attach to it.
Okay, number one, he talks about the fact that you have to do something about it. That's good. Prophecy, he says, here's a result of your activity. Whereas Ruach HaKodesh, he doesn't say anything about that. I suppose there must be preconditions, but he doesn't mention any of them. Good. Also, what about a difference in direction?
From you to Ruach HaKodesh seems to be more from you. It's more from Hashem just straight to you, and prophecy is more.
Okay, in Ruach HaKodesh, God puts something into your mind. In prophecy, you attach yourself to God. Now, just one more detail. In Ruach HaKodesh, when God puts something into your mind, where are you? You're here. Whereas when you attach yourself to God, you have to move. You have to make an attachment to God. In Ruach HaKodesh, he comes to you. And in prophecy, you go to him. The result is that in Ruach HaKodesh, when he comes to you, all he does is he gives you something. He sends you a message. And you receive it. But you're still very distant from him. In prophecy, you bind yourself to him. When you move to him, then you're connected to him. Direct attachment. And of course, it's the fact that you're attached to him that gives prophecy its much greater impact, much greater quality, as we'll see, than Ruach HaKodesh. Before we get to that, we saw another pair of terms closely related to one another, used together with one another, and I believe I made the same remark about those terms as well. One is where God comes to you, so to speak, and the other is where you go to God. Okay, it's way back in the first part. And it'll be again in the fourth part. It's just very briefly in the first part.
First paragraph?
First part. When When I confuse it, yeah, right. When I see Perek, when I confuse Perek with part, that Perek with part, you know, he set me out the pasture. Okay. The answer is Ahava and Yira. Love and awe. Love and awe have the same structure as Ruach HaKodesh and prophecy. Now that I've given you 98%, which goes with which? It should be obvious on general grounds, right? Awe goes with? Ruach HaKodesh. And love goes with prophecy. And awe over there in the first part, he says that a person who achieves awe of God, the Shekhinah manifests itself in him, around him. That's something that God sends of himself, so to speak, even down to the earth. Whereas the love of God, results in, expresses, is a symptom of, something like that, makes a connection to God. So just like the difference there, that a person who achieves awe of God, God sends him a manifestation. Whereas in love, the person attaches himself to God. So here also, in Ruach HaKodesh, God sends him ideas, information, knowledge. Whereas in love, in Nevuah, in prophecy, the person attaches himself to God, and therefore he gets a much more powerful experience. You with me so far? Okay. Now, he puts in one little catch, one little qualification. He says he should tie himself to the Creator and attach himself, real attachment, so that he should feel this attachment, that he's attached to what he's attaching. That is to say, kavodo, God's kavod. Kavod, I guess, could be translated as glory. Whatever that means. Now, most of you who have been with me in the Chumash year, where I took you through Moses' request of God, and where God says no, and then he gives him something else, and then he compromises with him. What does Moses request? Hareini noa es kivodecha. Please show me your kavod. And God says, I'll cause all my goodness to pass by you, and I'll be good to those who'll be good, I'll be gracious to those who'll be gracious. And Moses' response is, that's not what I asked for. But God says, well, you can't see my face and live. And Moses, I'm telling you a pre-tzadik now, and that's for the tapes. Moses says, well, I'm sorry, it's not what I asked for, and I'm not satisfied with being told that I can't have it. Finally, God says, look, I'll put you in the cleft of the rock, and as I pass by, as my glory passes by, and he uses the word kavod, so as my glory passes by, I'll put my hand over you and you won't be able to see him. When it goes past you, I'll take off my hand, you'll see me from the back. See me from the back, but not from the front. I say it's a compromise. I mean, the Prisadi says it's a compromise because he uses the word covered again. So finally, it's back to what Moses asked for three verses before. And God says, okay, you will have an interaction with my covered, but not a face-to-face interaction. Not an interaction without qualifications or restrictions. You can't have a full strength, direct interaction with my kavod, my glory, while you're alive in this world. But I will give you an interaction with it, an interaction. It will have to be watered down in certain ways. So it's very interesting that Ramchal here says that that's what Nevuah is. Nevuah, prophecy, is an attachment to God's kavod. Now, what this kavod is a very, I'm told, it's a deeply discussed issue, and I don't know anything about it. But it is not, so to speak, the Creator himself. The Creator himself probably, at least certainly in this world, is beyond our ability to attach to. But it is something of him that one can attach to and can be influenced by, and that's what prophecy is. And again, like Ruach HaKodesh, there's no delusion about it. There's no deception about it. If it happens, you know it, and you know it without any difficulty. As you know, that you're looking at a table. Because you look at the table, and I know, there are people who sit around in philosophy classes and debate, is the table really there or isn't it really there? But fundamentally, they're not doing this, because you can't doubt that the table is there. Just imagine, you're sitting here, someone tosses a ball at you, and you see it's going to fall on the table. Don't you calculate the bounce? No, I don't know if this table is going to fall right through you. Who knows what that? No, you calculate the bounce. You want to try to wonder if you have to get out of the way. I mean, it's just instinctive. When you have this experience, there's no way to turn. You can say the words, maybe there's no table, but you can't think it. You can't think it, and you can't feel it. It's just, it's instantaneous and instinctive. And he says the same thing will be true about a person who will have prophecy. It will be instantaneous and instinctive. That's what he's interacting with. Now, next paragraph he says something which is a little controversial. Not everybody agrees to this. He says, the essence of prophecy is being attached to God while he's alive. Period. You want to know what a prophet is? He's a person who's attached to God. There will be, accompanying this, various knowledge and understanding, even greater than that of Ruach HaKodesh, from the secrets that, of course, Baruch Hu keeps from everybody else, and he'll know them with clarity, with understanding that is given to him from God, greater power than people have Ruach HaKodesh. The thing that he's leaving out here, which many others will disagree with, and that is, to be a prophet does not mean that you're sent to anybody with a message. You may not have any job to do. It's just being attached to God and receiving that special infusion of knowledge and understanding. That's all there is to it. Some want to say the word prophet, nebuah, comes from a word for speaking, nips nasayim, expression of the lips. He's denying that. One thing on his side is the fact that in the Talmud, the Zohar Megillah says that from Moses to the beginning of the Second Temple, the period of Jewish prophecy, there were 1,200,000 prophets. The Midrash in Shir Shirim and Ruth says that it was 600,000 men, 600,000 women. Now, Ramchal will tell you, I don't suppose that they were all running around giving messages to people. That's not part of what prophecy essentially is. These were the people who were so close to God, so attached to His glory, that they had this experience. But doesn't mean they have to be sent on a mission. There were certain very special prophets who were sent on missions. And then there's a subset of those whose speeches and whose missions were significant not only for their time, but for later centuries and millennia. And those are the ones that are written down. So there's something like 55 men and 7 women who were written down in the Tanakh as prophets. But doesn't mean that those were all the prophets. Those were all the prophets whose messages and whose lives will be significant for hundreds of thousands of years later. But in addition to that, there was this gigantic number of 1,200,000 prophets. Yeah.
The Rambam agrees with our problems, doesn't he? Because I don't know if he said it, but I saw it in somewhere that the word Navi is actually like a doing word, right?
Navi
is like, that's what he does. And yet you see that there were so many prophets that didn't have to say anything, even Daniel.
So the Rambam would disagree.
One would agree that you could be a Navi,
yes,
and not necessarily have to be speaking out to everybody. I mean, it's just something that you yourself have. But Daniel,
yeah,
didn't give any prophecies, and we consider him a prophet because it's something that he was.
Okay, I don't know that number, so I really can't comment. Yeah.
And also, he says you have to be close to God, and now you have Gentiles who were prophets. Were they connected to him just and then took it the wrong way, and that's what made him bad, or what?
Like if you take Balaam.
Yeah, of course, Balaam and Lavan, and there are others. I think that this is a very good question, and I just want to make a remark of method. Don't put God in a box. Don't lock him up. There are rules, and the rules hold most of the time, normal times, regular times, expected times. But there will always be exceptions. And Chal says this in a number of places. You don't put God in a box. This is the normal definition of prophecy. But there could be people who get prophecy without earning it, people who personally aren't worthy of prophecy, and yet will get it because God wants them to be up to that prophecy for various reasons, like Bilam, as he mentioned. Right? I agree with you. I'm talking about the norm now. There certainly could be exceptions. Yeah.
But then it's not prophecy, then it's more Ruach HaKodesh.
It depends. It depends on whether they're having interaction with Kvodo, with His glory. If they're having a direct interaction with Kvodo, and they know that they're having an interaction, then it's prophecy by definition.
Prophecy by definition also requires the fact that you went out and
pointed out, that's what he said. He says you did that. But attachment couldn't be achieved from either side. A can go to B or B can go to A. Just that usually, as he says, Vekas is supposed to be an achievement. And so he asks, what about a non-Jew who didn't work for that achievement? Well, how can he get it? And the answer is, it's usually an achievement, but it doesn't have to always be an achievement. And there'd be exceptions to any rule.
Is it possible that God would choose non-Jewish person as a messenger?
Yes, of course. There are many degrees.
Some people can think of Bush being a messenger.
Enough.
He said that the... By the prophecy that it's being attached to God, and part of that is having the knowledge and understanding, which is higher than Ruach HaKodesh, but meaning that it's higher, just clearer.
It will be of higher things. The subjects will be of higher subjects. He says they'll be the secrets. The secrets that God hides from others. The Ruach HaKodesh gives you more limited knowledge and knowledge of things that are not as essential. He does say that with HaKodesh, the clarity is perfect, so it's not a matter of that. Now, this idea of clarity is going to be described in the next paragraph, so it's really very important. He says, however, the way in which this Hasaga usually means something that you come to know, or come to perceive, come to get, is done through intermediaries. Man does not attach himself and perceive God's glory the way he does his friend who's standing in front of him, but rather through intermediaries that serve this perception like glass to the eye. Like lenses. But even though there are lenses in between you and the object is always the same object. The object is God's glory, and the person having the experience knows that it's God's glory. Just that the kind of perception and understanding that he has depends upon the lens that stands in the way. Now here we have to be very careful. Because although there are lenses in the way, and they can be distorting lenses, still, there's no illusion, and there's no mistake, and there's no deception, and there's no failure of understanding. You have to understand how that can be. How can it be that you have a distorting lens, and yet, have no mistake, no deception? The answer is that the prophet knows what the lens is distorting. He knows what it is, and therefore he discounts it. It's a little bit like a black and white photograph. I don't think anyone is misled when he looks at a black and white photograph of a garden that these people have planted gray flowers and gray grass and gray trees, gray leaves. So what does he do? He just filters out color as a non-entity in the description. He can see the size of the trees. He can probably identify the species. He can see whether the lawn is close cropped or the lawn is luxurious. He can see how much of the lawn, how much is flower beds. He just doesn't read the picture for a color. He just filters that out. So similarly, a prophet who interacts with God's glory through these lenses, and the lenses distort So the prophet says, okay, but this lens comes labeled as size distortion. Okay, so I'm not going to read into this picture what the sizes are. I'm just going to discount that because the picture's not revealing that. So therefore, he knows what to read and what not to read. And what he knows to read, he reads perfectly without any mistake whatsoever. Just that there's material cut out. Now, somebody who has clearer lenses gets more of the item that he's looking at. Somebody who has less clear lenses gets less of the item. But no one is misled. No one makes a mistake about what he sees and what information is being communicated to him through the experience. Yeah.
So how clear the lens is defines how big of a prophet he is?
Yes. Yes, exactly. Now,
if you can work at that from the beginning because he's got all his tools, so then what's the difference?
Listen again. When I took a black and white photograph, I don't work out from the photograph what the colors are. I just discount the colors. I know I'm not getting the colors. If I see that there's a photograph of a garden, and I have a lens in there that blurs the edges, then I will not decide whether this leaf has on it a nice edge or whether it has a smooth edge, because I know the edges are blurred. Somebody else gets one with the colors out, but the edge is sharp. So he gets more information. The differences are immense. The only thing is that you can't figure back from the, you know, when something's blurred out, it's blurred out, and then you don't get it. Okay? Now, this statement is found in the Talmud, that everybody looks through these lenses, and you have more clearer lenses and less clearer lenses. Moses looked through only one lens, a lens of the greatest clarity, but it's still a lens, it's not direct. What they don't explain, really, is what is the cloudiness of the lens? What makes it cloudy? What significance does it have? You could say, just God wants to hide certain things from the person, and different people are at different levels of prophecy. Pritzadik has a wonderful explanation. Think of what it's like at nighttime when you're sitting in a room with lights on, and outside it's dark. Dark, I mean, there may be street lights, but it's much darker than it is in the room. Now, you look out your window to the outside. So you can see. But also, as you look at the window, at the glass of the window, you'll see a reflection from inside the room. So you get a kind of double image. You see what's going on outside, but you also see the reflection in the window. Now imagine if you're standing facing the window, direct, right angles. You know, straight ahead, head on. So what reflection will you see? You'll see your reflection. And your reflection in the window gets in the way of clearly seeing what's outside. Because you have a double image in front of you. Your reflection in the window will block out some of the light rays coming from outside. That's the problem, says the Pritzadik. You get in the way. There's too much of you in the experience. The more there is of you, the cloudier the lens is going to be, and the less it's going to come through. That was a beautiful, beautiful idea, let's say, and it gives an explanation to it. Moses, there are various sources indicating that Moses was the most absent, personally, from his experience of prophecy. One source says that the Shekhinah, God's presence, spoke from his throat. He made himself into a vessel which God was manipulating, so to speak. Put himself in God's hands totally. It didn't have to be filtered through him. He's the humblest of all men. The humblest of all men, the Torah itself says, means that there's the least there. There's the least of him there. So because he was least there, there was the least reflection on the glass, so to speak, and the glass was as clear as it can possibly be. For other people, because there's more of themselves, so then the glass is going to be cloudier, and that means more is going to be filtered out, and it means they're going to get less from the experience. You with me? Yeah.
I remember once learning the idea, I was just wondering whether the Rambam mentions it here, that when a prophet gets his prophecy, all the other prophets at that time also get the same prophecy, so that, because if he doesn't speak it out to the people, exactly how it was, then the other prophets will know that he didn't, or something like that.
Well, if you mean that when one prophet gets a prophecy, all the others know about it, that could be. If you mean that all the other prophets are also assigned to give over the same prophecy, that for sure is not true. Because we have a rule that no two prophets prophesy in the same style, in the same text. That's coming up with Jonah, we'll get to it. But usually, one prophet will know about what, but even there it's not 100% true. That's why when Rivka got the prophecy that the older shall serve the younger, and Isaac didn't get it, when Joseph was in Egypt and Jacob thought that Joseph had died, Isaac said, Chazal knew about it. Because he was a prophet, he knew he was alive. Jacob didn't know, even though he was a prophet at the time. So there are going to be exceptions. Won't always work. There will definitely be exceptions. Yeah.
Meditating and then trying to abolish or diminish the ego.
It's sort of like practicing your eye-hand coordination so that you can hit the ball, making sure your swing is level and exactly timed with the ball getting over the plate without holding it back. I mean, you're going through the motions, and they may be very well timed and very well coordinated, but you're not holding the bat, you're not going to hit the ball. When I was in America, my son has a cheder in Lakewood, and it was called the Moed Sukkah, so they took them to an amusement park. They rented in America, from communities, rent the whole amusement park. So they have it for the day. And I went, grandchildren were there, and there was a batting cage. I haven't picked up a bat for years. And they had the softball and the hardball, you know. And I decided to try for the hardball. I wish I had a camera. I actually hit the ball. That was amazing. Yeah, but if you're not holding the bat, so now, here, you know, according to Eastern meditation, you can empty yourself of the ego. But what replaces it? If the goal is to be empty, then you're empty. And then indeed, you could be like a starfish, you know, or a snail, if that's your goal in life, to be like a starfish or a snail. Our concept of meditation is to be totally focused on an idea. To empty yourself of everything else. So that your focus on that idea is total. Whether you focus on God or focus on the text of the Shema or something like that. So, to do it Eastern style, to me, is like, you know, perfecting your batting style without a bat. There's nothing there to use it for. Or, to put another way, what you're using it for is something self-destructive. If its goal is to convince you that you are nothing, then it's a goal that's leading you to a great, great delusion. You're not nothing. You're a divine soul, which is the most something that there could be in this world. And
you can make yourself close to nothing if you program yourself.
What's that?
You can make yourself close to nothing if you program yourself that you're nothing, right? So,
you know, I'm not so sure that's true. There's a story told about a Musar yeshiva. Now, Musar yeshivas were places where people worked on becoming better people and more holy and more spiritual. So somebody came to visit. And it was the evening period, that's like a half hour of the Musar state, at the time when the people work on making themselves better people. So they're all sitting there, 200 boys, they're sitting there and they're shuffling back and forth saying, I am nothing, 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 I am nothing. So this visitor looks at this and he says, there's 200 guys doing this, there must be something to it, you know. So he sits down also and he says, I'm nothing, I'm nothing, I am nothing, I'm nothing. One of the guys turns to him and says, you don't get to be nothing so fast. Uh-huh. Right. And then there's a Hasidic story of the Rebbe who sent his Gabbai out to check on one of his Hasidim, to check on his humility. The Gabbai came back to the Rebbe and said, your Hasid is doing extremely well. He holds himself very small. It's just that he holds everybody else a little smaller. So I don't know if you can just program yourself to be nothing. There's a lot of self-deception. There's a lot of self-deception in these matters. And you can think that you've done it and then find out that you haven't done it at all. Yeah.
I don't know if there's, I don't know if how contemporary this is, but from what I understand is that something in Musar is that you have a kind of a balance. You have to look at yourself. You don't want to have too much arrogance, but at the same time, you have to look at yourself as you're a human being, and you're a creation of Hashem, and you have a soul, and therefore you have to kind of respect yourself in that sense. So, I mean, it sounds like you're saying, look at yourself as nothing, and that's your goal.
I'm not going to do this in detail, but try this. You could look at your space, breath, pause, self, as nothing. That doesn't mean you deny the talents that are here in this locus, the talents that are here, but you look at your pause, self, as nothing. Try that. Now go to paragraph 6. When God reveals himself to the prophet, and the prophet feels the influence, he goes to pieces. He goes to pieces. The matter, the material, the physical in him, and all the limbs of his body are shaken, and he feels like he's coming apart. Because it is not within the nature of the physical to be able to survive this kind of spiritual revelation. Any spiritual revelation. All the more so, this spiritual revelation of God's glory. And his senses will cease to function. And his nefesh, the activities of his nefesh, will not function at all. And that includes his intelligence, and that includes his imagination, and that includes his feeling, and that includes his will. He ceases to have any control over himself altogether. And indeed, he falls on the ground, can't even stand up. And since the neshama, that's the higher part of the soul, is attached, it will have a great increase in its understanding, completely out of the normal human ability of understanding. Because this is not something that it has, the soul has because of itself, but rather because of its being attached to something much higher than it. And then, therefore, what it achieves is something much higher than it can achieve on its own. And in this, the prophet is greater than the one who has Ruach HaKodesh, because he achieves knowledge of something that's impossible for a human being to come to in any other way. Now, he starts by saying that what's attached is the higher soul. He has told us, however, that the elements of the higher soul are things that we don't experience in this world. Remember the extra soul of Shabbos? You have that on Shabbos, but you don't experience it. How is this experience of prophecy going to create a remainder that the prophet can then give over to others, or to act on, or to use as information for himself in his future behavior? In this experience of prophecy, it's the soul, the divine soul, that's receiving an attachment from above and is gaining a tremendous interaction with the above, and that's why the physical goes to pieces. It can't stand it. So he says there's an influence of this experience on the imagination. And the imagination, if you remember, is in the animal soul. So here's where it bridges over into a person's normal life. It leaves a residue in the imagination. When prophecy stops, when that higher part of the soul is no longer connected, and of course he then gets nothing from that higher part of the soul, what's left is what the residue is in imagination. And that is something which it can give over to others. He says it's the idea of prophecy in general, but there are many different degrees.
So what exactly would be happening to him in terms of him being transmitted and him getting what God gives him if there was no imagination? Does he only understand it with his imagination?
That's all. In other words, in the end, after the experience is over, I can't say what the experience is like. In other words, it's from his words, it sounds like, I don't know what some people describe what's like being receiving a strong electric shock. I mean,
is it like a person getting, like when you see, it's because of the light, you know? And so if there was nothing to accept that, so a person couldn't see, is that what it is? Like the imagination is the only thing, the only way you can see it?
Yeah, but when you say person, I'm worried about the ambiguity, what the person is over here. So in the experience, the upper soul is connected and it receives a tremendous infusion of knowledge and understanding. But that's up there in that part of the soul which I don't have any access to. Right? Now, when it's getting it, the rest of me is in shock. Because that higher part of me is having an enormous spiritual contact, and the body isn't designed to support that. I mean, we will see in the next chapter that Moses is different. Moses experienced prophecy in a different way. So this isn't absolute what I'm telling you, though. It's just for everybody except Moses. It shows you that it's possible to experience it a different way. But for everybody except Moses, the body can't support it. So everything just goes blank. And then the result is that the higher part of the soul is interacting and getting that infusion. Now, if it would be just like that, so when it stops, the body would recover and sort of like they've been out to lunch for that period of time and go on as it did before. There's nothing built into this picture where the regular person, the person not having prophecy, has any benefit from it or any effect from it. And that's why he says it crosses over the barrier into the imagination. So when the prophecy stops, the imagination still has a residue, and there he can communicate what he has left to others. Yeah.
Still clear in the imagination?
Yes, yes. There's no possibility to make a mistake. Yeah, that's a good point. No possibility to make a mistake then or after. Okay, now, that's the general description. Chapter 4, he talks about, in very general terms, how to get there. He says, when you get to the full level of prophecy, what I called yesterday a graduate prophet, so everything's clear, 100% clear, without any possibility of mistake. And he says what I told you a few moments ago. He says, even though there are different levels of what you get, still, some get more, some get less, still, what he gets with absolute fire.
I understand, but that would mean that what he said, that sometimes it wouldn't be clear, imagination.
Why?
Because over here it says, one who attains full level of prophecy, everything comes to him clear, with clear perception and full knowledge.
Yes.
So does that contradict that at all?
Why? Why would it mention?
Meaning that other people won't get it with clear perception and full knowledge.
Those who have not achieved the full level of prophecy.
So those people could, in their imagination, have things misconstrued?
That's exactly right. This is what I said yesterday when I talked about a graduate prophet versus a prophet in training. I think you remember that I mentioned that yesterday. So it's the prophet in training. When he's still in training, so then he could make mistakes. Listen, I'll do it inside, but I can't, if I keep mentioning it without defining it, because He doesn't put it in exactly these terms, but I think this is the picture. You know, we have a concept of smicha. Smicha is rabbinical ordination. Moses ordained. Smicha means putting on, laying on. He put his hands on people and ordained them as rabbanim. And that was a chain of ordination that went from Moses down till about the 4th century. Then, due to the Roman persecutions, that is to say, divine providence, the chain was lost, and since then we don't have ordination anymore. But to have rabbinical authority meant to be in that chain of ordination going back to Moses. Now, there's a similar chain of prophecy. A person may dedicate himself to God, and may achieve some level of attachment to God, and may have visions and all sorts of experiences. He's got to be certified by an already existing prophet. Only with that certification does he have the title of a graduate prophet, someone who attains full prophecy. And the difference is precisely this, that this guarantee that prophecy is absolutely clear, without mistake, without illusion, that guarantee only applies to a graduate prophet. A prophet in training can have real prophecy and make mistakes. He can make mistakes, misunderstand, misapply, and then what he should do is go to a graduate prophet and get certified. Or at least get this particular experience verified. He says later, Jonah. What happened with Jonah? God said, go to Nineveh and give the prophecy that in 40 days Nineveh is going to be overturned. He runs away, and God traps him, and he agrees to go back, and he gives the prophecy. What happens in Nineveh? The people repent, and God does not destroy the city. And Jonah says, see, I knew it wasn't going to happen. Even though I said it, I knew it wasn't going to happen. I know you're a merciful God. As I'll say, I know you're going to use it against the Jews later. Here I prophesied against Nineveh, and they did tshuva, and the Jews don't do tshuva. He thought that his prophecy didn't come true. Now, as I'll say, he didn't understand that overturned could be used metaphorically to mean that the society will turn itself into a different society. That all their priorities will be changed, that their goals will be changed, that their values will be changed. How could it be possible that he would not understand his own prophecy? Says Ramchal, because he was only a prophet in training. Which means that God will send a prophet in training also on a mission. Only then, part of the event is to see whether the prophet in training will use his position correctly. Or will not use his position correctly. So Jonah then comes out and made a double mistake. Number one, he should have gone to a graduate prophet and tried to verify how he understood what happened to him. Since he didn't do that, he ran away, which is a second mistake. And in the end, he had to be forced into doing what God wanted. Yeah.
What exactly happens in the process that's different from a graduate prophet that sort of misconstrues what the images are?
I don't know. He doesn't say in detail, but the easiest guess is that you have a distorting lens and it doesn't come labeled with what's distorted. The solution that I gave you before is how can you have a distorting lens and still not be misled? The answer is it comes labeled with what's distorted, so you can discount that. If it doesn't come labeled, or it might even come misleadingly labeled, we don't label it as true. You have to be able to see. This is written in disappearing ink, so it's going to go away later, or something. That would be, I think, the most natural guess. And at any rate, he says there's a whole process of training oneself to be a prophet. And in the Tanakh, you have a phrase that occurs a number of times, B'nai HaNavim. B'nai HaNavim, he says, are the disciples of the prophets. And what you had in ancient Israel were bands of prophets wandering in the hills with their disciples, the disciples being trained to become prophets themselves. And this involved meditative techniques. And I have a former student who's now working on the texts that we have for the meditative techniques of achieving prophecy or Ruach HaKodesh or other things. We have such texts. There's meditative techniques and periods of isolation, certain formulae that people recited over and over again. In this respect,
mantras?
Well, I guess that would be the Indian word for something similar. In this respect, you have what you have very often, that the non-Jewish world does indeed have some ideas of ours. For us, that would be natural. In Adam's time, he had all the ideas. Noah's time, he had all the ideas. There were people who were teaching these ideas. Abraham had six sons. After Sarah died, he remarried and had six sons. And the Torah itself says that he sent them off to the east. He gave them gifts and sent them off to the east. So, from our point of view, to find some contact between Indian beliefs, these Indians in India, and our ideas. Indeed, to find some contact between any human group and our ideas is the most natural expected thing. But in every case, you'll find distortions. In every case, you'll find mistaken applications, some of which we mentioned before. And that being the case, you can't trust them as they come. But the points of connection are there. Arya Kaplan has two books which are really very interesting and worthwhile. One is called Jewish Meditation, and the other is called Meditation and the Female Meditation of the Kabbalah.
Meditation in the Bible.
Meditation in the Bible. Yeah, Meditation in the Bible goes back to the prophets and talks about their techniques. And they're, if you want background on Jewish sources of meditation, that's the place to look.